You're listening to Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 16.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush.
Welcome back to a new episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who, and today we are going to talk about two episodes that belong together, Under the Lake and Before the Flood. Joining us today on the panel, Jimmy, Dom, and Stephanie. Stephanie, this is the first time you join us since the last season. Welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you back, and you've also been helping a little bit with the show notes behind the scenes with Inge. So thank you so much for all that work. Another person that I need to thank is Dom for taking care of hosting duties last time that we recorded the show. How was it, Dom, to fly the TARDIS by yourself?
It was great. I had a great panel to help me out. So I hope the listeners enjoyed that. But I'm glad to have you back at the controls.
I'll do my best. And also, welcome to Jimmy Akin. How is life?
It's going okay. How are you, Father?
I'm great. Glad to be talking about the Doctor again. I had fallen behind because I was in Rome and then just very, very busy life in general. And so today I watched three episodes nonstop to get all caught up, ready for this episode of the podcast. So let's waste no more time and start discussing this two-parter. But before we delve into the secrets of these two episodes. How do y'all like this two-parter structure of season 9 so far? Stephanie, what do you think? Do you prefer the single episodes, or does this work better?
Well, so far it hasn't been great for me. I mean, the first two I think were stronger episodes. They had a better understanding of the story and really came to a conclusion by the second episode. And in this batch, it seemed like there were a lot of strings they had to attach, and they found a really convenient way to attach them by the end of the episode of the fourth one. So I'm not as happy about the third and fourth episodes that we'll talk about, but overall I think the structure of two episodes can be good if they execute it well.
It definitely makes it easier for us because we don't have to do a show every week. We could just, you know, take the two together and have a long discussion. Jimmy, you've been watching so much Doctor Who over the centuries. What do you think of this new two-parter structure? Does it work?
I think it works. We've only had two-part episodes so far, so we haven't really seen a lot of experience with this format. But in principle, I think it works. I think that over the last couple of years, a lot of the stories that were standalones felt really rushed. It felt like they were trying to do really big epic stories in 44 minutes, and it often felt like they just didn't have enough space to tell the story that they wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Dom?
Well, I want to echo my other panelists in saying that so far it seems okay. My fear is that they've decided on a narrative structure for the season of two-parters, and that we're going to find that that at some point there's going to be two episodes and not enough story.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like these two episodes this time almost fit that.
Yeah,
I felt like, you know, maybe this was 1.5 episodes worth of story.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was a bit drawn out, and it could have wrapped a little sooner. But I kind of feel like do two-parters when the story needs it. Do three-parters or four-parters when the story needs it. But I'm not sure about, you know, it almost feels like a gimmick to say, you know, this season every episode's a two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm afraid of, you know, trying to the story takes second place to the narrative gimmick.
Could be. I wonder why they introduced it. It could just be because it works better for the ratings, or it's an experiment that they want to do, because now, of course, they can introduce cliffhangers, at least between those two episodes. And perhaps that might, you know, give them a nice spike for the second part. For me, I had the same feeling as Dom. Like this episode felt a little bit too long. I got a bit tired of the same environment all over again. Thankfully, in the second part, we went to this location, to this military base, but I felt it was a bit thin in the end.
To answer your question about why they may be doing this, they've had themed series before on Doctor Who, where the whole series was themed in a particular way. An early example of that was the final episode, the final season of the second Doctor's tenure, which was a big 12-part episode or 12-part series known as the War Games. They then had, like in the Tom Baker era, a season that was themed as the Key to Time, which was a big MacGuffin hunt where they were collecting pieces of a magical artifact called the Key to Time. Mm-hmm. Then they had, in the Colin Baker era, the Trial of a Time Lord series, where the whole season was the Doctor being put on trial. One of the things that Stephen Moffat has tried to do, rather than have big story arcs like that, he has had story arcs, but one of the things he's tried to do is change the format of the seasons. So initially we had like the Amy Pond River Song stuff, which was very soap opera-esque and based on developing character relationships. And you had a lot of elements continuing from episode to episode. And then he consciously said, okay, we're done with that now. Now we're going to go do single episodes. And we got a bunch of single episodes. And so this feels like he's trying to shake up the format a little bit, just to vary it for purposes of varying it, to kind of give the writers some guidance in terms of how to make a consistent feel for the season, but also to have it be different than other recent seasons. So he's, I think, trying to keep the series from getting stale and just falling into a certain type of formula.
And that is definitely something I can appreciate, that they keep just shaking up the bed and trying something out. And it's almost unconventional nowadays in the big budget, big media world in which we live, that they keep, you know, kind of this edgy feel to the series. Like, you never really know what they're going to do next year. Whereas a lot of the television that we watch is formulaic, and it's like, well, once we have a winner, we'll just keep doing that until nobody watches, and then we'll just cancel it. But for Doctor Who, they cannot run that risk, because after all, in this episode, or at least in the first one that we will talk about, Under the Lake, we learn that Doctor Who is still well known in 2119. And that the Doctor actually has a fan over there in Caithness, Scotland, in this underwater mining facility, who happens to know everything about the Doctor. And I don't really know if they are, you know, if this is if the Doctor is a celebrity in the fictional world, or whether they are referring to actual episodes airing, you know, having aired in that universe. It's kind of like really transdimensional, this whole fandom. Because how can this lady know so much about the Doctor?
In the second episode, they established she formerly worked at UNIT.
Ah, so she must have. She must have seen all the archives. I missed that. But anyway, it's good to know that the Doctor, you know, might still be around in about 100 years from now. So let's go to Scotland. We are introduced to this underwater mining facility called the Drum. I never really got whether that was a joke or just, I don't know, are they referring to Scottish drums or something? But it is underwater, and it's actually very deep underwater. They explain that there's been a dam breach and the whole, you know, area has flooded. And they're so deep underwater that they have artificial, you know, day and night cycles. And I'm thinking, I want to check on Google if this is possible even in that area. So the area where it's located is actually the upper north of Scotland itself. It's a very cold area. Actually not that many mountains, but lots of water. And I Googled a bit, and I found that there's actually one dam that I could find and a reservoir that was opened by the Queen Mother in 1955. And I came across a photo, and it looks nothing like what we see in these episodes. It's actually a very small dam, and it's nothing really spectacular. So I guess this must take place in a kind of like other version of Scotland. And this is clearly gearing up for Halloween. I'm trying to think if they did this in previous seasons. I assume they did. They always have like a tie-in with Christmas, of course. And I think we've seen ghosts. And wasn't the whole Weeping Angel stuff, wasn't that also for Halloween?
I don't remember if Blink itself was originally a Halloween episode, but I know we've seen ghosts before, and we've certainly seen, you know, creepy undead. There's the "Are You My Mommy?" little children in the gas masks from the
empty child.
The empty child, right? But I, you know, ghosts seem to be a long running feature, or you know, things that look like ghosts but really aren't, as the doctor will tell us, seem to be a long-running feature of Doctor Who. But I don't know that there's always a Halloween episode, because, of course, I don't think Halloween is as big in the UK as it is in the US. Or it's getting bigger.
I mean, it's so well known. Even in the Harry Potter series, they refer to Halloween. It's kind of this you know, worldwide thing because of the predominance of American media, even here in Europe. So I'm guessing that is at least must have inspired them to do a ghost episode. And the reason that we see ghosts so often in, you know, science fiction and scary television series is because it's one of the cheapest special effects that you can do. You basically just do two versions of a scene, and then that the person in one version will appear translucent if you mix the images. So it's really simple to do. Of course, this was a slightly more advanced ghost special effect, because they had the hollow eyes. You know, the you could look inside the crane of the cranial space of these zombies or whatever they were. So we then get introduced to the crew. The immediate question that I had is, why the deaf crew member? Because that's something that is pretty rare. I do remember I recently watched the last series of Heroes before it got canceled, before the reboot. And there was also a deaf woman, actually also a deaf actress, who features pretty big in that season. But that's kind of rare. You hardly see that. And so I was wondering, is this a plot point? Is there like a second layer to this? I mean, we see the ghosts speak, but we can't really hear them. So I was thinking, is that the thing? And I'm still, even after seeing both episodes, I still wonder, was that really on purpose? Or was it just a thing that they wanted to do?
I think it was partly because of just to give representation to that group of people.
Which is great, I think. That's absolutely fantastic.
But also, it did play an important plot role, because as a result of her deafness, she has lip-reading ability that nobody else is going to have.
Indeed.
And so when the ghosts are mouthing things, she's the one who's able to figure out what they're saying and so forth. So I think it was a mix of things. They could have had her just as an ordinary crew person, but making her the second in command, so once their original leader becomes a ghost, she's now in command, she's making the decisions, and she warrants having someone there to be her translator. All of that adds importance to her character and provides greater representation for the deaf community on the show.
Yes. Yeah.
My only problem with it was that, unfortunately, it's a British show, she's not speaking American Sign Language, so I couldn't understand any of it.
Do you know sign language, actually?
I know some American Sign Language, yes.
Wow.
I'm friends with a family that has a deaf daughter, and I also have a deaf cousin. And so I learned enough American Sign Language to babysit a 5-year-old.
And it's completely different.
Conversations.
It's completely different, isn't it? It's like
yes,
you can't understand a word or a sign.
Exactly. American Sign Language is actually more similar to French Sign Language than to British Sign Language.
Really?
So I was trying to follow her hands, and then I realized, oh, this is never going to work. This is British Sign Language.
I used to know sign language, but I replaced it with semaphore.
Good one.
It's a little more dramatic with the big flags.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm glad we don't have a semaphore version of this podcast, because that would be really tiresome for an hour waving flags around. Crew, of course, well, seems to know, or at least one of the crew members knows who the Doctor is. And we then quickly hear that one of the ghosts that is seen in the underwater station is actually an alien, according to the Doctor, and from the planet Tivoli. And I was thinking that Tivoli was a place in Italy without any aliens, but beautiful scenery. But Jimmy or Dom or Stephanie, you must know something about this history. This must be a planet that we've seen before.
We've seen the race before.
Oh, the race.
It's the kind of mole-like guy, and he is a member of a race that loves to be dominated by other races. We previously saw them in another episode a few seasons ago, which I absolutely hated, called The God Complex. Mm. And it was during the Matt Smith era. The Doctor and Amy were trapped in a kind of creepy hotel with another person from this race, and also a Minotaur that was feeding off of people's faith.
Oh, yeah, and I remember that one.
This was by the same author, and I hated that one so much that this was a delight by comparison.
Wow. It was a bit strange in the second part of this story to hear the Undertaker, you know, like submit himself and then trying to lure the Doctor into come to his planet and dominate them. And it almost had a little bit of like a second meaning there. It was really, really weird. So those creatures are around. We still don't know exactly why they are there. We get introduced to a Faraday cage. My first question was, why a Faraday cage in a mining facility? And a few minutes later, the Doctor asks the same question later, and it appears to be part of the nuclear shelter that it used to be.
You know, Father, may I hop, mm-hmm. hop in here for a sec?
Sure.
There's something I noticed at the beginning regarding the relation between Clara and the Doctor, which is that when they arrive, you know, she's trying to get him to kind of continue on and, hey, let's go on to this more exciting thing. And it's almost like she's entered the final stage of companionship, mm-hmm. where, you know, the companions, after a while, they start to kind of drag the Doctor forward. They want to lead him into more adventures. They become adventure junkies, in a sense.
Yeah.
And some of them, right? But many of the ones in the reboot, you know, in the new series, and it's kind of interesting to me to see, you know, this progression. Although we get a little bit of a hint of why she's so manic about the adventures, because she's trying to use the adventures to cover her grief. Mm-hmm. She kind of hints at that later on. But one of the things I came up with is why does she just assume that there's no adventure here? You know, they show up, and then her first thing is like, oh, there's nothing here. Let's move on. You know, let's just mm-hmm. go. This is boring. Let's go on to another adventure.
Well, it came across to me almost as if she's using the TARDIS in the same way we were using our remote to zap from one channel to another. And we give it like a fraction of a second. It's like, this is boring. Click next channel. It's almost like she opens the door and, wrong channel. Let's go to another one. And, of course, the base doesn't look that appealing. It's basically a big circular kind of styrofoam construct, and there's not much to see there compared to what she's already seen. Of course, I mean, she's been to the outer edges of the universe and to mm-hmm. you know, impressive planets with tremendous culture, and this is just boring. What struck me was the contrast with the Clara that we've seen in the previous season, and this almost felt too superficial, too contrived and forced. And in the first part, I was like, "This is bad writing. This is not Clara's not supposed to be like that." And then in the second part, you do get a hint that she is in overdrive because she is still mourning. She's Stephanie, what's your take on the way Clara is evolving in the series?
I did notice that in the first part she had a conversation with the doctor that I thought was pretty poignant, and he basically just said, you know, you've had all these things happen to you, and now you're totally focused on me, and you don't have anything else in your life, and I want you to have more in your life.
Yeah.
So I think she's kind of just forgetting about all these other things that have gone in her life, and she really wants to be having a laser focus on being the companion and being there for him. And it's, I don't know what it's going to do to her, but it's probably not going to be good to have just the laser focus.
Yeah.
I'm glad that Don brought this up. I wanted to talk about this too, because she really is behaving like an addict at this point. And the doctor kind of has a conversation with her in part one where he's trying to encourage her to put on the brakes and be a little more cautious. And she's not having any of it. She's like, yeah, I gotcha. Don't worry about it. And then in this more recent episode, she is talking to him in terms of he's shown her a whole new thing she can be. And so she's making this adventuring central to her identity, and he must not dare let her down.
Yeah.
And so she's holding him responsible for her personal satisfaction and direction in life. And all of that, she's really throwing off freaky codependency vibes. And I'm suspecting we're building towards an actual intervention. And the doctor, I think this is all connected with how she leaves the series.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect we may even get a downbeat departure where the doctor has an intervention and says, for your own good, I can't bring you with me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to find something else.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. It's definitely, I mean, that surprised me. And I like that about this two-parter, is that my initial impression was wrong, because there was actually a reason to her behavior. And so I had to give the writer a little bit more credit in the first part. It's going to be interesting to see where they will take this character, if there's going to be something. Because I'm feeling that if she stays like this for a number of episodes, it's going to be a little bit, it's so superficial. Nothing happens anymore. She's not evolving. There's no surprise in her character anymore. Whereas the doctor keeps surprising me. You know, his style, I get a very different vibe this season than I had of Capaldi's doctor in the previous season. He's intriguing. There's something going on. I mean, there's this theme of dying and you know, I don't know. There's something going on. I've got the feeling that they're preparing something, you know, like a bigger arc. But I can't really tell where it's going. Well, I have to ask, what do you all think of the goodbye to the sonic screwdriver? Oh my gosh, they just abolished the sonic screwdriver. Can they
It'll
do
be
that?
Back.
You think?
Oh yeah, they've had the doctor go off the sonic screwdriver in the past as well. And for writing reasons, because they felt in some prior seasons he had become too dependent on it. And so they wanted to, back during the Tom Baker era, for example, they had him put away the sonic screwdriver for a while to force him to MacGyver his way out of situations to make for more interesting storytelling instead of just waving a magic wand. And certainly during the Matt Smith era, we really got the magic wand vibe from the sonic screwdriver,
yes,
where he could just do anything,
mm-hmm,
except wood. And so I think it makes sense to kind of put that away for a while. But then they've just replaced it with sonic sunglasses.
Yes,
so now
yeah,
the sonic sunglasses are the new magic toy.
Switching to wearable technology. I thought that was a nice pun to, you know, the whole Apple Watch craze.
I'm glad they didn't do a watch. That would have been a little too much on the nose.
Yes. But the glasses didn't make sense. That was, again, it was like, why did they introduce these sunglasses? He was wearing them in that dark theater, and it was just strange.
They probably have night vision.
I actually thought that the electric guitar would be a much better candidate to, you know, for whatever waves that thing could be transmitting. Although it could be a little bit more inconvenient if you have to open a door to you know, take out your electric guitar and play a song. But there was actually, wasn't there a like a rock version of the theme at the beginning? Or was that in the second part?
The second episode.
Oh my gosh.
That whole soliloquy that he did at the beginning, I was like, what is he talking about?
Oh gosh.
I don't understand this. And then he takes out the guitar and then leads into the rock intro. It was very confusing. I didn't get it.
Did we want to jump to that? Because that's a very interesting...
No, we'll jump to that a little bit later. I first want to stick a little bit with the first episode. Otherwise, it's already timey-wimey enough for me right now.
Speaking of the first episode, you asked a question about why would a defense base or why would a mining facility have a Faraday cage.
Yeah.
Actually, it's probably not that big, but you probably have one in your house or flat right now. Because
really?
That's what a microwave oven is. Microwave ovens are Faraday cages. And that's why you can see the food being cooked inside of them, even through that wire grill, because that's screening the radiation and keeping it in there and letting the light through.
Wow.
And people have suggested if we ever are in danger of a catastrophic electromagnetic pulse, like from a nuclear bomb or a major solar storm, stick your cell phone in your microwave and it may help shield it and keep it from melting down.
Just don't turn it on.
Don't turn it on or it will melt it down.
I thought you were going to suggest that we all, you know, step into a microwave.
If it were big enough, but as being biological, we're less vulnerable to EMP effects.
That's true. And a car, of course. Isn't that also a Faraday cage?
That I'm not aware of.
It's more of a protection from lightning in the sense of it's grounded.
Hmm. Good. I'm getting my things. I'm not ready to be a doctor. So I've took some very random notes, but there was this one joke that was, I think, the best joke so far. It's the cards. You know, the cards that the doctor can read when he's not empathetic enough. Did you all freeze frame it?
No. Oh, yes, absolutely. No one today is going to die / be gelatinized / yeah. Those were awesome.
Hilarious. And I wonder who wrote them. I think it's Clara's handwriting, right?
I love this idea that the doctor is like he's becoming a little self-aware of how he comes across, or like that Clara's helping him understand that he's kind of, you know, in some ways, because I have some friends, he's somewhat like almost like Asperger's, like on the spectrum, they say.
Yes.
You know, where he doesn't, emotions sort of elude him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't understand these social interactions. And so he needs help with these social interactions with other people. And I've actually heard stories of kids who themselves have Asperger's to a degree or another, who really love Doctor Who because here's someone that's like them, who is successful and, you know, a hero. They don't necessarily identify with Superman or Captain America, but they identify with the Doctor because he's like them in many ways. And so love this idea of the cards to help.
Kind of like Monk for OCD.
Yes, Monk. It also reminds me a little bit of House MD, that same character who could also be extremely insensitive and a genius at the same time. Couldn't care less about the patient as long as his genius mind was fed with interesting cases. Capaldi does remind me a little bit of that. And then, of course, the doctor always is not just in the situation, but he also sees the bigger picture and why this is an adventure worth his time. And I'm struck by how much the doctor is fascinated by death. And he prods the crew, is like, how can you not be excited about this? You know, if these are true ghosts, it means death is gone. Death was the only unifying thing that all living creatures had in common. And since, well, it appears that there are ghosts. So he's like, why don't you ask more questions about it? And I'm thinking, you know what? That's actually a very good point. Because I'm thinking beyond the series, like death is the one thing that everybody is going to confronted with, and yet we always seem to push it away. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to dwell on it. And even in our, you know, our scientific pursuit, we rarely really think about what death is and what it does to us. And I don't know. I was thinking this would be a great conversation starter if you want to use Doctor Who for, you know, I don't know, like a youth group, and you want to talk about these themes. If death is so prevalent in our lives, if it's the natural thing, and ghosts are unnatural, as the Doctor puts it, why don't we talk about it more? Is that just a taboo that I perceive over here? I'm not sure what the situation is in the United States. If it's here, you rarely hear people talk about it.
I think people are afraid to talk about death because it confronts them with bigger issues of faith and of thus, you know, behavior. Mm-hmm. If I have to confront death, then I have to confront what happens after death, and in our, you know, Judeo-Christian and in Islam too, your behavior before death affects, you know, your disposition after death. And people, I think a lot of people don't want to be confronted with that. They want, you know, that's so big, and it's unknown. It's that unknown country on the other side of death, which is one of the reasons I think why the Doctor gets so excited is, well, now it's not unknown anymore. If we can talk with people who are dead, they can tell us what's on the other side. Mm-hmm. And it's just this excitement. I mean, it's an immortal, and he's essentially immortal, who, you know, it would take someone who's lived 1,000 years to understand what an adventure, the one adventure that he can't have yet is
exactly
the adventure on the other side of death.
Yeah, because that's the difference. I mean, he's not, when he regenerates, it's not a resurrection. It's just a, like a kind of a reboot. But he's never been on the other side of death.
Right.
Nor has anyone alive, actually, except for Christ. And let's see who else was risen from the dead.
Lazarus,
of course, and the little girl. And
the guy who was resurrected by Elijah's bones.
Yes. But what I liked in this episode was his enthusiasm, almost like he's embracing this, like, let's talk about death, whereas most of us are like, let's not talk about death. And in a way, our whole celebration of our, you know, Halloween, which of course comes from All Hallows Eve, and it's very connected to the Catholic celebration of the commemoration of All Saints and All Souls, especially the imagery around it is almost like a way for us to talk about death without really talking about it. You know, you it's scary stories, but you don't really have to be afraid because it's all kind of like everybody's just dressing up and it's all fake. So it seems like a way to kind of deal with it in a way that suits us more, that doesn't scare us to death.
A question that I was interested in regarding the ghosts is what precisely they're supposed to be, because
yeah.
I think the show is somewhat ambiguous about that, because mm-hmm. it doesn't want to endorse the idea that souls of the Christian sort are real. So these can't be ordinary souls, because you can't, at least if they were, it would be really scary, because you can't program a person's soul to broadcast the same words over and over into outer space. that would be totally creepy. And so the Doctor, on the one hand, and this, I know he does this in part two, he refers to them as souls and says that the Fisher King robbed people of their deaths mm-hmm. and converted their souls into electromagnetic emissions. And so these are sort of, maybe we have an entertaining of the idea that the soul is real, but this seems to be some kind of electromagnetic representation of it rather than the soul itself or something.
I wonder if it's you know, supposed to be some kind of representation of a brain pattern. You know, our brains are electromagnetic impulses firing off, and, you know, to use some of this, you know, pseudoscientific gobbledygook, you know, it maybe that's what these ghosts, you know, these souls are, is really just these patterns, you know, downloaded like programs. Mm-hmm. Into some sort of free-floating device. I mean, something is generating them in some sense. maybe the ship or something like that.
Well, they seem to be tied to the
imply that it was tied to the electromagnetic field of the planet.
Yeah, yeah. And then even if that is, if there is like a technical explanation, or like why is there no brain inside that head? Why the hollow eyes? I mean, it's just science fiction, so perhaps we shouldn't be asking these questions. It looks scary, that's why.
Exactly. It makes them look dead.
And then did you see the pun? I thought it was a little bit, I don't know, where the doctor is all like giddy and wants to ask so many questions. They're like, calm down. He's kind of talking to himself. You're behaving like the time that you met Shirley Bassey.
That seemed to come out of nowhere. Shirley Bassey, just of anybody that he was excited to meet. That's awesome.
Well, and it's almost like you're behaving with these ghosts as if you've seen Shirley Bassey. I don't know. I'm not sure if Shirley Bassey is happy with this quote. I didn't know the TARDIS had a cloister bell. Is that a new feature?
That goes way back. That's been with us since... Oh, I know it was used in the time of the Fourth Doctor. I think it precedes that. It may go back to the Second. But the cloister bell is used whenever the TARDIS senses grave, grave danger.
Oh. I thought it was awesome because of that connection with the ghosts, and it kind of it's very fitting to hear a sinister bell. But the way that the Doctor talked about it, it's almost as if the TARDIS is afraid. It doesn't want to go there.
Exactly, and I thought that there was some really interesting stuff with the TARDIS in this pair of episodes, because mm-hmm. It's been established the TARDIS takes us where the Doctor needs to go, not necessarily where he wants to go, and so the TARDIS felt a need to bring him here, and so even though Clara doesn't see that there is an adventure here, the TARDIS knows that there is one and that the Doctor can help with it, but then the TARDIS doesn't want to go too far into the adventure, and when it learns about the ghosts, it wants to leave. The Doctor locks it in place. Then in the next episode, when the Doctor is trying to get out of the situation, the TARDIS refuses to take him. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a bit of unprecedented willfulness on the part of the TARDIS. And it's in a way becoming more willful as time goes along, because they've established it doesn't want to go to places like Trenzalore. And this time it absolutely refused to take the Doctor somewhere. And I think that's a nice setup for a possible future episode where we could have an actual falling out between the Doctor and the TARDIS.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
I keep wondering where, what the true backstory of the TARDIS is, because this is almost like a living being. It's almost, well, self-aware. It is a living being, but so. I don't know.
Well, I was going to say we had that episode where the TARDIS was personified as a woman.
Yeah,
the Doctor's wife.
Mm-hmm. The Doctor's wife, and so it was very I thought it was enjoyable to kind of see this where he could actually interact with the TARDIS on a personal level, in a back and forth. I mean, there is this almost husband wife relationship between them at times where he's he's this exasperated couple who are fighting with one another. Just to get to where they need to go, and it's an interesting relationship. I mean, he has this relationship with the ship, which actually, is a fairly common trope in science fiction. We know that Kirk in Star Trek has a relationship with the Enterprise, and as does Han Solo with the Millennium Falcon. I mean, they talk to the ship. Scotty even maybe more so than Kirk in Star Trek, but this is much more of a real personality behind the ship that takes our hero where he wants to go. I find it like Jimmy, a fascinating idea where we could the story ideas that could come from this.
Yeah, I mean, you can just imagine carrying the husband-wife analogy further. What if they got so at odds with each other that they decided to separate, and would the TARDIS then try to find another Time Lord to take her on adventures? And how would the Doctor react with jealousy to that? And you could see a number of possibilities there that could be cool to explore.
There's always Missy or the Master, or like a little flirt on the side. I always thought that whole metaphor of the the TARDIS being like a woman is like referring to the way that some people treat their car, like talking to their car, giving their car a name, and
there is, but they've I mean, and actually back in Classic Who, they stressed the TARDIS is alive. Mm-hmm. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, in the very first episode, someone touches it and goes, "Ooh, it's like it's alive," mm-hmm. and then they build from there. And they have, I remember in the third Doctor's time, he was very consciously hinting to people, this is actually alive, it's conscious, even though it looks like it's a wooden box. And later in the new Who, they established that TARDISes are grown. They're not actually built. They're grown from a kind of TARDIS coral.
Wow.
And this particular TARDIS, from her perspective, decided she was bored on Gallifrey, and so she stole a Time Lord and left.
So we then see that another crew member is killed. So it follows this classic. Actually, they refer to Cabin in the Woods, that movie, yeah. Which is kind of like a parody of all the tropes in scary movies, and that what's happening right now in that underwater facility is exactly that. And one after the other gets killed.
It's also exactly what happened constantly in the second Doctor's time. This is a base under siege plot.
Mm.
And base under siege, because of budgetary limitations in the second Doctor's time, loads of those episodes were base under siege episodes. It was kind of a criticism. That they were, many of them were too much the same. It was just another base under another siege with people running through corridors.
Yes.
Well, and we've seen this a lot even in the new Who, which is, you know, with the Water of Mars, the Moon Egg, not one of my favorites. We've seen a lot of these episodes of the Jim says, the base under siege. Is it a crutch? Do they keep returning to it because it's easy and relatively inexpensive, you know, apart from the sets? I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, is it a sign of lazy scripting or story, story creation? Or is there more and more to mine from this type of, you know, it's just a backdrop for a very interesting story? I don't know. I enjoyed the story, so I feel like it. To me, it feels like just a backdrop on which to build a new narrative.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also just a way to save money, because you only have to build one corridor, and then you dress it up and you change the lighting a little bit, and so you simulate a bigger environment. I it could work. I have to say, I was very glad that in part two we got to get outside again. You just see a different environment, because it became a little bit too much. It's like the episode where they went inside the Dalek.
The Dalek.
And that too, it all looked the same. It was just filmed in an old warehouse or factory, and they had used that before as well. And it's just lots of pipes and steam, and yeah, we've seen that.
At least we're not getting alien planets that are just the same rock quarry over and over again.
What do you mean by that? Which captain could do that? So, and Pritchard, of course, gets killed because he's not a very nice guy. And it was a bit underdeveloped, I thought, that whole plot of him, you know, being... they seem to suggest that he might have stolen the power unit or whatever, but he gets killed way too soon, so we never find out what his true motives are.
And he's such an unlikable character. You know, he's the corporate representative. He's putting other people at risk. So, of course, this man must die.
Of course.
You see that coming a mile off.
And you keep rooting, of course, for the nice people. And most of them survive, although not all. But that gives it a little bit more, more gravitas. Yeah. I like the ghost chase in the first episode. It was just pure cinematic, basically chasing these ghosts, trying to trap them in the Faraday cage. But I thought it was well executed and did have some tension. And I'm still thinking, they must have been very creative using that same corridor over and over again, and yet giving us the impression that, that this is a big system.
Yeah, and they helped by showing us maps so we could at least theoretically relate this corridor segment to different places.
Yeah. I was actually quite...
I wondered why they needed one, more than one person to lure the ghosts. Like, why do they have to keep switching off? Because then you have the problem which they encounter, which is they split up. And maybe that's why you just they just had to introduce some complexity so that they would split up and you'd have that moment where Lun is alone with the ghost. And we get that little bit of hint of why Lun is the one that's safe from the ghosts.
Or perhaps they're just they're all out of shape, and so they need to, they need to tag, otherwise they're not going to make it. Yeah, it's teamwork. It's, but I like that part.
Share the rest.
And then we get, of course, once the ghosts are trapped, then Cass comes in, and we understand why she is brought into the plot as a deaf person, because she can read their lips, and that's how they find out these strange words, which happen to be coordinates. And they figure out that it's pointing to a church. I have to say that part was a little bit techno babble to me. Like, yeah, whatever. So coordinate. And then these words engraved in the ship that are working like magnets, and they rewire your brain. And I like the idea behind it. You keep humming the song for an entire day. I actually have that when I listen to music in the morning.
Earworms.
That earworm can be so strong, and to kind of transpose that on an eternal level, that, you know, once these coordinates are in your mind, that will keep you in that loop for the rest of eternity as a transmitter. Thought was interesting, but it just was so weird that characters on the wall of a ship can rewire your brain.
It's not very plausible. And then there's the other question. Wouldn't it be easier to just turn on the shuttle's antenna and use that to broadcast your message?
Mm-hmm. I thought
it's still fun.
It was a bit convoluted, I think. But we
a lot of times in the story that were just used for convenience to lead us to the end when they tried to explain it but really didn't.
Mm-hmm. And we do get that, of course, all this is probably for this pilot that is in suspended animation. So they're kind of working towards the second part where we will discover who that pilot is or what it is. And then
I totally called it. It was going to be the doctor.
Yeah,
the box.
Yeah. I immediately I was like, yeah, that's the doctor.
Yeah.
I still don't know exactly how he pulled it off because it got so timey-wimey that I got a headache. But I love the quote towards the end of the first part where, I have to go back in time. How do you do that? Extremely well. It's brilliant. So, and then, of course, you get the big cliffhanger that the doctor is now a ghost. And that's where the episode ends. And in part two, you don't get to see that immediately. There's some more exposition going on before we finally figure out what happened. A bit similar to the cliffhanger that we had in the first two episodes of this season, where the first part ended with the doctor pointing the gun apparently at the boy, but then ultimately, of course, we understand that he's shooting something else, the growing hands. Scariest alien ever. But but that revelation, that kind of reward for you coming back from that cliffhanger is all the way at the end, almost as if they don't want you to know it too quickly.
They want you to hang around for this episode too.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I feel a little bit manipulated. And that's where the episode ends. I thought it was a good cliffhanger, but I was a little bit worried that the second part would also be entirely in that environment. But it wasn't. It wasn't. So let's move to Before the Flood. Speaking of the titles of the episodes, I know that you had a discussion about the title of the second episode of season 9. And I heard, I have not listened to the podcast yet, but I heard that, that actually there was some information coming in later that explained, that gave the probably the pun that was intended in the title, Dom. Was that, did that, what, which, wasn't it Mike or?
Which, for Which is Familiar?
Yeah.
I think, Jimmy, you had some insight into that.
My take was that the Magician's Apprentice, the first part of the two-parter, was probably referred to Clara, but might have referred to Davros, depending on what they established. They didn't end up establishing Davros as the Doctor's Apprentice in any substantial way, so my original assessment of, I think the Magician's Apprentice is Clara. We see her functioning as kind of his call screener, for example, with Unit in that episode. So she's taking on some of his functions. Mm-hmm. And then I think she's also what's being referred to as the Witch's Familiar, because the witch, being a female magician, would be Missy. And Missy more than once compared Clara to an animal. And so she was also, and then we have that kind of comedy anti-buddy routine between Clara and Missy, and so I think Clara is both the Magician's Apprentice and the Witch's Familiar. That was my idea anyway.
Okay.
And a familiar often, I think in the legends, would sometimes take other forms, so it would become, you know, a cat, or, and then it could become a person, or, you know, or an imp or something like that. Well, in this case, Clara kind of became a Dalek. And so that was, I think that was where we kind of came to seeing her as both the apprentice and the familiar in that case.
But these two titles of episodes 3 and 4 are very straightforward, Under the Lake and Before the Flood. I don't see any second meaning to that. So I was a little bit disappointed there. They have been more creative before. Before we talk about the whole Beethoven thing, which was quite extraordinary. First, let me ask you a question, and I'm going to ask it to Dom first, because he's the self-proclaimed Star Wars nut, the second one here in the room. I noticed two Star Wars moments in this episode. Which ones are they?
So what do you mean by Star Wars moments? Like
reference, that, like, something that has to do with Star Wars.
Tick tock. I'm not sure what you're thinking of.
Jimmy, did you catch them?
I didn't. I mean, I thought I might have seen a Star Wars reference go by real fast, but I don't remember it at this point.
Stephanie, any idea?
Nope.
All right. Well, there were actually two things which made my heart leap with joy. The first one was, did you notice Prentice's business card? So the Undertaker, the alien?
Oh, yes. That's right. May the remorse be with you.
Exactly.
Oh, I didn't see that.
I thought it was brilliant.
After freeze frame.
And there was a second Star Wars thing in this episode, which I only discovered when I saw the credits for the episode. And that is the voice of the Fisher King. You know, we've heard that voice before in the Star Wars universe. It is the voice of Darth Maul. It's the same guy, Peter, and then he's got this Polish complicated name. And they replaced the voice of the actor who played Darth Maul, who is a great martial art guy, but he's got this very high-pitched, you know, British voice, and he speaks like that, which is not really the kind of voice that you want Darth Maul to have. And so they had this gravelly voice. And so Peter, the name escapes me, but anyway, he apparently is quite a well-known commodity in the voiceover business in the UK. Well, it's so cool to have Darth Maul kind of being channeled through this Fisher King. let's go from Darth Maul to Beethoven. Almost like a cold open of this show. It's like, what is happening? The Doctor is talking to the camera. He's breaking the fourth wall. Not only that, he's talking about, he has this strange theory about time loops and paradoxes, and then he tells me to Google it. What is going on? Stephanie, what did you think when you saw that?
I don't know. I'm hoping you have better ideas because I did not get it at all.
Did you Google it?
No.
I was kind of astounded that they essentially told us what was going on or what the resolution was going to be right at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah,
I mean, he's
yeah.
basically telling us this whole episode is the bootstrap paradox.
Yes.
And so for the rest of the episode, I'm looking for, okay, where's the paradox going to come in? It was pretty astonishing. Although the question that my wife Melanie had as we were watching it, she said, well, no, see, Beethoven is way too well attested in history. And I'm like, no. It's not about Beethoven, as he tells us. But it's just an example.
Yes.
But we've seen this before in other movies. It's the can you be your own grandfather paradox that we've seen in other time travel. And it's the sort of time travel stuff that makes my head hurt.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Trying to think about it too much.
It got extremely wibbly wobbly in this episode. But I love it. So basically the idea, just to kind of summarize it, is that imagine there's a big Beethoven fan and he travels back in time and meets Beethoven. But instead of Beethoven being the guy who came up with all this great music, he's just a guy, you know, and just a little deaf, but he hasn't written a note. And then this fan is like, but what about my music? So he has all the sheet music with him, gives it to Beethoven, which ends up being the reason that he goes back in time to meet the Beethoven. And then, of course, the big question is, so who wrote that music? Was it Beethoven? Was it the guy who brought? No, it wasn't him because it was music from Beethoven. So where did it come from? It's kind of like this causal loop or causality loop? Causality loop.
Causal loop. Yeah.
Causal loop. So it's like who was the first cause? Interesting in philosophy as well and even theology, you know, who's all the causality in creation, and then God, of course, is the first cause, but he's kind of beyond our normal causality. I love those discussions.
Now, some science fiction tries to solve this or to kind of give a solution to this by positing the quantum universe theory where when you go back in time and you make a change, what you're doing is creating a new universe and a new timeline, whereas the original timeline still continues on. So in this sense, the timeline in which Beethoven actually wrote the music continues on, and you're in a alternate timeline in which Beethoven hadn't written the music or something of that sort. But clearly, the Doctor Who universe does not subscribe to this theory, but would rather posit this who wrote the music question, which is an interesting, I mean, there's no resolution. They don't offer us a clear understanding. They just want to drop the mystery, bam, right in your lap, deal with it.
Yeah, talk about it over dinner.
Right.
A few quick thoughts on the subject. The bootstrap paradox, for those who may not be aware, is the name of it comes from the idea of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, which involves a kind of physical equivalent to the paradox. You know, how can you, if you're holding on to your bootstraps, how can you pull yourself up by them?
Yeah.
It's interesting that they had this monologue at the beginning where the Doctor is addressing the camera, possibly breaking the fourth wall. He did something similar in the episode Whisper, where he was kind of in the TARDIS ranting alone about this idea he had. And some people have suggested, well, maybe this incarnation just talks to himself in this way. Maybe he's not actually technically breaking the fourth wall. You know, whatever. I personally don't have a problem because I talk to myself when I'm trying out explanations for other people. So I could see the Doctor doing that, especially since he's a little unhinged to begin with. What I had a problem with was what Dom mentioned, which is they're telegraphing right at the beginning, this is going to play an important role later on.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets you up for looking for the bootstrap paradox as the resolution of major points in the episode. Like, especially because he talks about going back and not finding there to be a Beethoven and thus becoming Beethoven. And so when we're hearing about this not yet seen Fisher King, it raises the question, is the Doctor going to turn out to be the Fisher King? Also, when we have the Doctor looping back 30 minutes in the past, you could say, okay, the unlooped version of the Doctor is the one that's going to die and become a ghost, but because we have this looped version, that's the one that's going to continue in the future, because we have two parallel versions of the Doctor at the same time, and you could have a bootstrap paradox going on there. So when they eventually pay it off, and this is my problem, when they eventually pay it off, it's on a very minor matter about how a hologram was programmed.
Yeah, yeah.
And it didn't live up to the attention they gave it at the beginning of the episode. And I thought at the time, and I may be wrong about this just because I like time travel fiction as much as I do, but I thought, why are you bothering to explain this to people at the beginning of the episode? I mean, you're really hammering this. Anyone who's a fan of time travel fiction has encountered this idea before. They won't need this big explanation, and they could have better used that time explaining what actually did happen at the end, which seemed to me to go by real fast.
It did. But then again, yeah. Not everybody who's watching Doctor Who is very much into the time travel science fiction genre.
True. One other theory about why that's at the beginning of the show, it may be because this episode ran short. One of the problems that filmmakers have is they sometimes script something and then it doesn't take as long on camera as they thought it would, and they need to come up with new material. And a classic way of doing that is to add a scene at the beginning that's not connected with anything else, because it's much easier to just slap something on the beginning than it is to flesh out action that's already happening. And so if you watch like a lot of old B-movies that for some reason have a lecture by a professor on a general theme related to the B-movie at the beginning, that's why. It's because the movie ran short. They needed a longer runtime.
Good point. That actually might be the reason. But I liked it anyway because it was funny. It was unconventional. It was surprising. It almost felt like an experiment. Let's break the fourth wall. As if he's recording a selfie on a floating iPhone or something like that. And I love that little quip of like, just Google it.
Yeah.
At that moment, I actually paused and I Googled it. And the first search result that comes up, of course, is Wikipedia. And then one of the next ones is so funny. It's a website and it has this text as the first paragraph. So the Doctor told you to Google the bootstrap paradox, and now you're here. Okay, let's try and explain what on earth he was talking about without using all the words wibbly wobbly. I thought it was so genius to do that. It felt like the Doctor told me to Google. I Google, and the internet is talking back to me.
There are a lot of pop culture references lately. In these two episodes, there was at least three or four. There was the mention of Shirley Bassey, the command to Google it, and then there was the other one where he's talking about the earworm, and mentioned some song by some songwriter who must be a British pop singer of some sort that went by me too fast for me to catch. But we're seeing a lot more of these pop culture references that, in a few years. You know, in 5 years, maybe they'll be very dated. I mean,
of course,
I'm sure Google will be around, but it's interesting.
I don't really care that much. If you look at Back to the Future 2, with all the that is so dated now, but that's the charm of it as well. I mean,
I think we're seeing more of it. They've made a conscious decision, I think, to add more of these in. And it's an interesting decision. I don't have a problem with it myself. I just and sometimes it's kind of fun when they reference something that you're familiar with outside of the show.
Yeah, yeah. And it's always like a double entendre. It's not really required for you to get the reference to follow what's going on. It's usually just little throwaway quips that they inserted. I think it's fun. Sometimes I even suspect the actors from just ad-libbing and just adding stuff. The pilot we discover is called the Fisher King. And I always thought that had to do with the Holy Grail, right?
Yeah. The Fisher King is a figure in Arthurian mythology who is wounded and unable to rise on his own, but is connected with the Grail and has a castle where the Grail is attended by various maidens, and and I forget it all, but
but he's just.
But this didn't have much connection with that. I mean, why is this thing called a Fisher King?
Yeah, I've felt a bit cheated or disappointed at the end of the episode, because with a name like that, you kind of imply that this is going to be this big revelation, and it's going to be very much about the theme of death and eternal life, you know, and
King Arthur and the Holy Grail.
Yeah, and it's just a monster. It's just terrible.
It doesn't even seem to be an aquatic monster, because it says they're going to drain the oceans and enslave the humans, and then it apparently drowns in a flood.
Well, he did welcome the flood, because he's got his hands open, and he's like, finally. But it was a bit weird, that whole monster thing. It was a great monster. It looked fantastic, and I think the cosplayers will have a field day trying to recreate this, but... Yeah.
My big question is, was he really dead? I mean, was this the plan all along? I don't think that was ever explained, unless I missed it. But, you know, why was he wrapped up? Why was he on the hearse? Was this a deception, or was he I'm not dead yet? And then so he got up to walk around and realized, hey, here's a nice planet for the taking, and decided to take it. I was very confused by that part of it. I just didn't understand why he was there.
Yeah, they didn't explain that well at all.
No, that whole last part, it just went over my head. Like, okay, I'll just take it on faith, you know, something time stuff is happening, and, you know, the only thing that I want to see is the two TARDISes and two Doctors, and that kind of like almost an homage to the Back to the Future 2 moment where, you know, Marty sees his own self, and that kind of stuff. It's just a trope again, but it's a trope that I like very, very much, including the thing, yeah, well, we need to get involved and prevent this person from dying, and no, you can't. You're going to mess up the timeline. The question that I had, of course, is the Fisher King tells the Doctor that the Doctor is so afraid of messing with the timeline and changing even a word. And I'm thinking, really? Haven't we seen the Doctor going back in time and fixing stuff all the time? I mean, I don't think the Doctor is very respectful of of the past or the future.
And in fact, he actually doesn't need to change a thing, in a sense. You know, all he has to do, you know, the future that the Doctor has come to protect... is all he has to do is do what he had done before, which is kill the Fisher King, jump in the box, send the TARDIS with Bennett back, program the hologram. In essence, the Doctor doesn't actually change a thing in order to stop the Fisher King, because we already know that the Fisher King doesn't succeed to bringing his invasion fleet to Earth in 1980.
Yeah.
We have not been defeated by them. So, in a sense, the Fisher King is, I don't know if he's right that the Doctor doesn't like to change things, but the Doctor doesn't have to change anything. He just has to do what he had done in the previous timeline, which is all those steps. So, like we were saying before, it's almost like there's not enough butter for this toast.
Yes.
As far as the story goes.
So they seem to set up for much something happen. Much bigger. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A bunch of stuff happens and then we're done. And some of it's very cool. And to me, the best parts are the relational parts. Where I know we're kind of jumping around a bit, but where Bennett confronts the Doctor, telling him that he was willing to let O'Donnell die in order to save Clara, and the Doctor doesn't deny it.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, the Doctor...
It's pretty dark.
Yeah. And the Doctor says Clara must not die. He's willing to do anything. And to me, that was the really more interesting parts of this. So it's kind of, you know, it's really what we've got here is developing this relationship between Clara and the Doctor throughout these two episodes, we're heading to a culmination.
Yes. And Clara is frightened to death that the Doctor will die. And she says, I'm not ready to accept. You do that with my successor. I'm thinking, they're dropping a hint here.
I was going to say we have a heretofore unknown feature of Apple's FaceTime.
Yes, we can do it transdimensional. I love it. And apparently,
we've had like the superphone. We've had the superphone before.
Yes, but then now it's an iPhone, which is kind of funny.
It's definitely FaceTime. Plus, did you see the monitor that he can just turn it around like a phone?
I love that idea because I'm constantly telling people to do that when I'm FaceTiming. Turn it sideways, and they incorporated that into the show, and I thought that was great. I love that bit.
Absolutely, and it's kind of interesting to think that Steve Jobs might have been involved in the construction or at least the upgrading of the TARDIS. They could have gone back in time and just asked for his input, you know, in one of those secret labs of Apple. Just give me an interface with whatever iPhone people are using in 2015.
Well, Johnny Ive is the Doctor. I mean, that's we've determined that.
Well, I don't think that the TARDIS, you know, is up to Johnny Ive's standards when it comes to the let's say the outward appearance of it.
The industrial design.
Yeah.
It's not milled from a solid block of aluminium.
Oh, that would be great to actually have a crossover episode where somehow they involve Johnny Ives in this.
Well, the interior of the TARDIS looks like an Apple store.
An Apple store. Always bigger on the inside than it looks on the outside. All right, back to the episode here.
I thought I'd comment on something that it was just kind of there, but if you think about it, you go, why? Why did they make this choice? This Scottish town has been redressed to look like Russia.
Yeah.
And one of the characters says, why have we gone to Russia? And the Doctor says, we haven't. This is Scotland, but we're in the Cold War. It's 1980. Mm-hmm. And so the town has been redressed to look like Russia for purposes of staging practice invasions and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so that's all fine. That works as an on-screen explanation, but I found myself wondering, why bother? Why not just film somewhere? Why redress everything to look like Russia? And after thinking about it, I think I finally figured out why. It's because they're planning to blow that dam and flood the town. And if there were people living in this town, they would have to stage a mass evacuation scene. That would cost a lot more money. It would also ramp up the number of people who are in danger from the Fisher King, and that would complicate things further. And so I think as a cost-saving way, they wanted a ghost town. And this was the easiest way they could figure out to have a ghost town in England. It's like, okay, it's during the Cold War. It's redressed as Russia for staging exercises.
But they just could have gone with a military base. It would have been visually less attractive, but
yeah, but even then, if it's a standard military base where people are stationed regularly, then you've got the same problem. You have to show them being evacuated or have them all die. So you want some place that there's a reason why people aren't there on a regular basis.
Yeah. It did remind me.
That just happened to be the choice they made.
It reminded me of that little fake town that was introduced in the Indiana Jones movie that we don't talk about, the fourth one.
Yeah, the Forbidden One.
Yeah, the Forbidden One, which is the last thing I'm going to say about it. TARDIS, fridge, stuff like that.
Anyway. Yeah, bigger on the inside.
Faraday cage of Faraday. I was thinking, it just hits me now, Beethoven, of course, was deaf. We have a deaf crew member. That seems to be an ongoing theme as well. Mm. Almost as if these two episodes are kind of like, I don't know, perhaps there's a theme month or so on the BBC or in England. But anyway, it's
good. It kind of would have been cool if they paid off the deafness. Like, yeah, he didn't actually write anything. He was deaf.
That would have been interesting, yes.
Hiding in plain sight.
Yes. Oh, well, they didn't. Could have been, you know, they need more listener input or more viewer input in these episodes. So the Doctor wants to protect time. He's afraid of changing the future, says the Fisher King, of course. And because, well, perhaps if you change one thing, we might end up, says the Doctor, in a future where the world is ruled by cats. I'm thinking he's talking about Facebook.
Well, be.
My Facebook feed is ruled by cats, so perhaps Facebook is the result of a time experiment gone wrong. I don't know. I really like the ending of the emotional ending of the episode, because with all the time stuff, it got very complicated, and I just gave up on trying to understand. But I was surprised by the way in which they kind of brought it back to the very personal level of making sure that because life is fragile and you might lose people, tell people that you love them before they die, et cetera, et cetera. I thought, and I really liked what they did with Clara here when, you know, this guy is, I forgot his name, but he's mourning. And Clara is the only one who understands. Like, I understand what it is. And that all of a sudden you get the depth that I was missing in her character.
I'm thinking we make a Danny Pink back at this point.
Oh.
We still have Orson Pink from the future, who is a descendant. And I'm suspecting that it may be tied to Clara's exit. May get Danny Pink back, and that may provide her exit from the show.
That might actually be the only reason for her to stop traveling with the Doctor, if that hole in her soul is filled.
Filled. Yeah.
And it might also explain why the Doctor in this episode or in these episodes seems to emphasize a little bit more that she should not just be dependent on him, but should seek someone else in her life. And could be. I'm hoping. I like happy endings, at least for the companion. So
I'm guessing it'll be bittersweet, however it happens. Yeah. The two previous times they've tried to write her out of the show, where the actress Jenna Coleman wanted to leave, we got bittersweet endings both times. The first one was at the end of the season, where they've defeated Missy and the Cybermen, and and Danny Pink is dead and gives up his chance at a new life to save the Afghan boy that he killed. And then we have the Doctor and Clara saying goodbye, and they hug, and it's very tearful.
Mm.
And then at the end of Last Christmas, as an old woman, she's dying.
Yes.
And they pulled back from having her leave at both of those times, but I'm just suspecting her final departure is likely to have a theme like that kind of feeling. It may involve the kind of intervention that I was talking about earlier, and it may involve getting Danny Pink back. That would seem like the logical way to do it to me, but I don't know exactly what they'll do. It's got to be better, though, than the way they had one of the Doctor's sixth Doctor's companions, Melanie, leave. At the end of an episode, she suddenly announced that she was in love with a character that was a psychopathic space pirate and was going to go with him.
Okay.
No development at all. Just, I'm leaving with the psychopath.
Bye now. Well, I guess we'll just have to wait, because there's only time will tell an appropriate way to end this episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who. I want to thank my panel members. And of course, final question, where can people find you in this universe? Stephanie.
You can find me Twitter or Facebook, Angel Steph, and my podcast is tvrewindpodcast.com.
tvrewindpodcast.com. Jimmy, where can people find you?
They can find me at work at catholic.com and also at my personal website, jimmyaiken.com.
And Dom, always active on the interwebs.
You can find me on all social media and on my website, bettnet.com, and BetNet everywhere.
And you can find me as Father Roderick on Twitter. And if you type that in, chances are that you will find a couple of links that will have to do with this priest from the Netherlands that is doing stuff on the internet. So thanks for listening to this episode. We will be back, of course, with a discussion about the next two episodes. And so stay tuned. Thanks for listening. And if you want to check out more of our shows, check out sqpn.com for all our podcasts. Take care now. And you know what? I should play a jingle at the end of the episode. I totally forget. There it is. I was like, this is, you know, it's not cool enough. We need some music.
You can always go back and record a monologue for the beginning.
Yes. This podcast wasn't long enough, so I'm just adding a jingle, 30 seconds to kind of wrap it up a little bit. Oh, and something happened. I don't know what. My computer froze. Well, there you go. And now it starts again. You know, my computer is like the TARDIS. You can never really trust it.